I'm Dave Rubin, and I'm thrilled to be hosting this live Q&A session with Dr. Gad Saad about his new book, The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. Dr. Saad, the book just came out 2 days ago. It's selling like hotcakes. I think that's a reference that the young people understand. And yet you've made time to answer the good people's questions. You're a good man.
Thank you. And I should say you're even a nicer man because you agreed to do this. When they told me who should moderate this event, there was only one name that was possible, and that was the great Dave Rubin. So thank you.
I'm thrilled to be part, and it only seems fitting because you've been on my show roughly 400,000 times. So I'm returning the favor, although in this instance, I'm not going to ask you any of my own questions. I'm going to ask you audience questions because people have been submitting questions about the book and the writing process and the whole thing. And actually, your audience, I don't want to inflate their egos, but these people are pretty good because some of
they're
these questions...
They're pretty smart, aren't they? I saw some of the... Before we start, Glenn Beck, the last time I appeared on his show, said to me, you know, stop saying in my forthcoming book, you have to say the name, The Parasitic Mind. So I took that to heart and I wanted to show him who the true marketing guru is. So whenever I want to wear a mask, this is the mask I wear. Whenever I get hungry and I want to have a cookie, you said like selling like hotcakes. Where is it? Check out the cookies. Can
there you
see?
Go. Yeah, we got it.
Edible cookies. And whenever I'm thirsty, I drink my... So all of the tastes are covered by the parasitic mind. It nourishes your soul and your mind and your stomach. There you go.
You know what? For the first time, I believe you're a marketing professor. I finally now see it. I thought you were just, it was just a lot of intellectual fluff, but now I fully see it.
Boom. There you
I
go.
I see it in action. Okay, let's get to it because there's a ton of great questions. We got about 45 minutes. And of course, the link to buy your book for people that are watching that have not bought the book already, you can get it on Amazon and your local bookstore and all that, but there are links down below. I thought you'd find this one interesting as the first one. As a social anthropologist, I experience the postmodernist nonsense every day, and on your advice, I'm no longer willing to sit by in silence. What is, in your opinion, socially constructed?
Right. So for the viewers who may not know, social construction is the idea that a particular phenomenon is not due to any biological imperatives. It is socially constructed. Why do women like a particular type of guy? Oh, they must have learned it through Hollywood images. Why do we like fatty burgers? It's because McDonald's taught us that. So, of course, some things are socially constructed. It's the old nature-nurture issue. But the reality is that most things that are due to that we say are due to nurture are in that form because of nature. So really the dichotomy of nurture versus nature is frankly imbecilic, because it isn't as though nurture or social construction exists outside of biology. Mm-hmm. So most things are ultimately nature, but there are some things that have nothing to do with biology. Why a particular culture associates the color green with fertility, whereas another culture associates it with disease, might be just a social accident that has nothing to do with biology. But for all intents and purposes, everything that we are is a melange of social construction and our genes.
When you see the crew of people that want everything to be socially constructed, what do you think the evolutionary rationale is behind that? Is that just that they want to just sort of control the world? They want to control the universe? They want to control existence?
That's a great question, because you say, what is the evolutionary reason for succumbing to the social constructivist mindset, which is a great question. I think it really
that was mine, by the way. Just saying.
That's
mine.
True. Which shows that not only my fans are smart, but my friends are very smart, too. Look, social constructivism is really a hopeful message, because it basically says, hey, parents, when your child is born, anyone can be the next Michael Jordan if you provide him or her the right, you know, socialization. They can become the next Lionel Messi, the next Albert Einstein, the next Michael Jordan. We're all born with equal potentiality, and then it's only a matter of how well you socialize them. So that's hopeful, because I'd like to think that my child is going to be the next Lionel Messi. It's perfectly hopeful and perfectly incorrect, but it makes me feel good. So I think it really stems from a noble place of hopeful, you know, dogma, but it's nonsensical.
Okay, number two, you trace human behavior back to evolutionary strategies such as spicy food in India or kosher food. Is there anything socially constructed that has no Darwinian purpose? I like this question.
Right. So I guess I preempted that question by answering the previous one where I talked about colors, right? The fact that one color associates, you know, green with fertility and another one associates it with something else might have nothing to do with Darwinian theory. The fact that in my leisure time, I enjoy reading, whereas you might enjoy bowling, those are individual differences, behavioral heterogeneity, that may not have an evolutionary root. So it's very, very important for people who wish to understand the world through the evolutionary lens that they don't overcommit to evolutionary theory, because what ends up happening is they try to come up with explanations for every possible phenomenon. Oh, the reason why we love bowling, it's because it harks back to our ancestry when we're trying to kill the zebra, and so bowling. So it's nonsensical explanations that really have nothing to do with evolutionary theory. For something to be an evolutionary phenomenon, there's a very strict code of evidentiary threshold that you must meet.
Right, but there could be, there are certain evolutionary reasons that we like sports though, right? For example, true. Like the idea of winning in competition is that
absolutely. As a matter of fact, in one of my earlier books, and you know, in evolutionary psychology, I talk about how fans, so the consumption of sports experiences, and both you and I are big sports fans. I know you love. How are you doing with getting Clyde Drexler on the show? Have we?
His ball is right. Is it my right shoulder or my left shoulder? I always forget. His signed ball is right there. We're working on it.
Okay, very good.
Because of COVID, I want to do it in person. You know.
I understand. So when two teams play, the players of the winning team will have a rise in their testosterone. The losing team will have a drop in the testosterone. Well, that seems to make intuitive sense. But what's incredible is that the fans of the winning and losing teams exhibit the same endocrinological response. If I am a fan of the French team and they win, my T levels go up. If I'm a fan of France and they lose, my T levels go down. So that demonstrates to you, if you like, the evolutionary roots of our tribal affiliation to our favorite sports team. That's why we even use language like, we won, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't win. You didn't play in yesterday's game. You're just a fan. But when they lose, you don't say we lost, they lost. So I associate with the winners. I disassociate it from the losers. And that's certainly an evolutionary mechanism.
Interesting. All right, let's shift to politics. We're gonna bounce all over the place here. Yeah. With an upcoming election and a Supreme Court hearing, how do you see idea pathogens you warn about in your book playing out in the next month? I mean, this question gets to almost every reason I've had you on my show so many times, because you're an expert in evolutionary biology, but you've been able to kind of apply it to politics.
Exactly.
And I don't know if you know this, but there's an election in about a month. So explain it to us, Gad.
So several ways to go with this question. One, as I would say, so there's a tension in ethical system. There's something called deontological ethics, which is there are absolute truths. It is never okay to lie. That's an absolute deontological statement. A consequentialist statement would be, it's okay to lie if I'm trying to protect your feelings. So if I want to have a long-standing happy marriage and my spouse says, do I look fat in those jeans? I might want to lie because I want to protect her feelings and have a happy evening together. The reality is we're all at times consequentialist and at times deontological. But when it comes to certain first principles, we should always be deontological. Now, let me link that to the SCOTUS issue. When people went after Brett Kavanaugh, some of them are common friends, they became consequentialist. Presumption of innocence didn't matter. Evidentiary threshold didn't matter, because there was a more important consequence, which is we need to get rid of this guy. So the first principles went out the window because it was important what the ultimate result would be. And I suspect the same thing is going to happen with this current nominee. They can't accuse her of being a gang rapist going up and down the East Board raping everybody in sight, but they can accuse her of other things. So I satirized this. I called her the fertility extremist, right? Because people were attacking her for having had five children and adopting two. And the two that she adopted was a manifestation of her colonizing black bodies, right? It wasn't because she is noble. She is taking two young black children out of Haiti. No, she was a colonizer of black bodies. So I suspect the same kind of tribal nonsense will happen.
Yeah. Does that explain so much of the way you look at politics, basically, the sort of two ways to deal with the truth? Because it seems like you can, of course, say Donald Trump lies all the time, and it can sort of just come at you very obviously, versus often when, say, Democrats lie. I know you were tweeting about the VP debate last night. The lies are more about what their policy positions are, where Trump has sort of these big over-the-top bombastic statements. They lie about policy issues, and it's just sort of a different way of lying.
I agree. So you're right. Trump will say, I've got the biggest penis in the world. Just ask my wife. Okay? So it may be a lie. It may be that Ron Jeremy has a bigger penis, some of you may know that reference or not. But his lies are, as you said, bombastic. I'm the best. I'm the greatest. Nobody loves me as I'm the best president. Whereas not only do Democrats lie about policy issues, they actually lie about something more insidious. They lie about the epistemology of truth. What do I mean by that? The scientific method is the means by which we adjudicate positions. We want to test the hypothesis. We use the scientific method. Well, the Democrats now argue there is no such thing as absolute truths, because postmodernism says everything is subjective. We are shackled by our, you know, our personal biases. Hashtag science must fall. The scientific method is only one way of knowing. Maybe you need to go to the indigenous way of knowing to adjudicate environmental issues. All of that bullshit is not coming from Donald Trump. It's coming from the left. So yes, Donald Trump lies a lot, but the left lies about the pursuit of truth. That's a much bigger lie.
Yeah, I wonder, did you notice last night how often, and Hillary used to do this all the time, but when Pence would make a point to Kamala, she laughs it off and smiles it off. And there must be a trick, a sort of, is that an evolutionary trick or a psychological trick? When someone's telling you something that you know to be true or calling you out on some sort of BS that you've put out there, and your reaction as opposed to confronting it is to just laugh in their face
I'm not sure if it's evolutionary, because in my view, it's actually suboptimal, because when I see her doing that, I'm increasingly more repulsed by her. And I'm always fascinated by the fact of why is it that when my wife and I are watching, is it Kamala? Is that how you pronounce it? I don't want to get it wrong because I don't want to be racist.
I keep saying Kamala, but it's Kamala,
whatever.
Yeah.
So whenever Miss Senator Harris speaks and does all her smug stuff, both my wife and I will look at each other and we're truly repulsed by her ways. And yet I can go on Twitter and someone says, what the hell are you talking about? She is so charming and lovely. So what is it in my neuronal system that causes me to be so connected to their experience? I'm not sure.
I'm fascinated by that. Just real quick on this, you know, I saw Hillary posted a little 2-second video of Kamala turning to Pence with that smug, snide look. And she said, you know, she was in effect saying, this is so wonderful. And I'm looking at it going, you got to be out of your mind. So we just look at these things differently.
The only thing I can think of is that your tribal allegiance ultimately altered your perceptual reality, right? So let me tell you a story that speaks exactly to this point. This is a story that was recounted to me from my former doctoral supervisor, Jay Russo, who's a cognitive psychologist. So he had been contracted by a company to try to help them decide whether to launch a product or not launch a product. Some of the executives wanted to launch it, others didn't. And so they held a focus group with some consumers or some stakeholders. They sat behind a one-way mirror to see the interaction. And at the end of that interaction, the yays, the ones who wanted to launch the product, said, you see, we were right. And the nays said the exact same thing. Well, how could that be? How could they both have seen the exact same interaction, started from opposite points, and resulted in exactly, you know, solidification of their positions? Well, that's exactly, I think, what happens when we look at Kamala Harris. You and I look at her and we say, my God, she's grotesque. Someone who loves her ignores all that information and finds her charming and smiley.
So thus, when I say we're in a war on reality, I'm actually correct, I think, is what you're saying.
You're exactly right. We construct our reality based on our perceptual biases.
All right. Well, this is actually a perfect segue then. Can you discuss the tension between truth and feelings, which is taking over in society today?
So You're blocked, by the way. Okay, is that okay? We're okay? Good. In the book, I talk about something that I call epistemological dichotomania, always trying to come up with binary categories to describe something, thinking versus feeling. The reality is humans are both thinking animals and feeling and thinking animals. When I walk down an alley and I see four young men loitering and my heart starts racing, that makes perfect sense. That fear response makes sense. The fact that my affective system kicked in makes sense. If I were trying to do well on a calculus exam and I'm trying to be affectively driven, I'm not going to do very well. I need to trigger my thinking response, my higher order cognition. What ends up happening in politics often is that we trigger our affective system rather than our reasoning system. So, example, Obama is tall, he's lanky, he's majestic, he speaks with a mellifluous voice, he's got a radiant smile. My God, I'm intoxicated, I'm in love with him. By the way, imagine this to be the cork of a wine bottle, right? There's an expression in Arabic to get drunk by simply smelling the cork of the wine bottle. I don't need to drink the actual wine. I just get drunk by smelling it. Well, this is what's happening when I look at Obama and I go, oh my God, I'm intoxicated by his magisterial nature. On the other hand, when Obama speaks, he's brash, he's disgusting, he's brazen.
Trump.
And so I despise him. And I think we discussed previously on your show, that becomes an aesthetic injury. So all that I've said right now is completely affectively driven. It's driven by my feelings. I detest him. He disgusts me, right? You haven't said a thing about his policies. This is what upsets me so much about many of our common friends, right? If you actually ask them specific policy points, they wouldn't be able, as a matter of fact, they might agree with Trump, but he disgusts them. So don't use your affective system in the wrong context.
Yeah. Do you think we live in a time right now, perhaps because of social media, that the affective system, the feeling system, is just more powerful than the fact-based view of the world?
I mean, to some extent, I think you're right, because the velocity at which information, moves doesn't allow for, great intellectual pontifications, right? So it's much easier to use a fast and frugal heuristic like my feelings. I'm pissed, shut up, racist, right? That doesn't take a lot of intellectual commitment on my part to elicit the affective system. So I think you're onto something. I think that the velocity, the rapidity of social information exchange on social media maybe weighs much more on the affective system than the cognitive system.
It reminds me sort of, you see this all the time. Some journalist will say something over the top and it'll get 40,000 retweets. And then they realize it's factually wrong and they calmly correct themselves and it gets 3 retweets. And it's sort of like, oh, the emotional one worked for everybody and got everybody crazy. But now facts, not so much.
Well, I'm sure you've probably seen or heard of the studies that look at, for example, a negative review will reach 10 times more people than a positive one. A lie will reach a lot more people than a truth, right? Which, by the way, speaks to something that is relevant to my book, In the Parasitic Mind. So people often tell me, well, your idea pathogens, is that similar to memes? I mean, yes and no, because idea pathogens are genuinely parasitic. They're akin to the parasite that enters an organism's brain and causes it to behave maladaptively, whereas a meme could be positive, neutral, or negative. But mimetic theory is actually the study of why certain memes spread quicker than others. So in the same way that viruses could either be more or less contagious, why is it that some memes can spread like wildfire and others not? And that, by the way, that study is an evolutionary-based study.
It would be interesting if your next book was a follow-up where you actually maybe co-wrote it with a biologist, right? Because I suppose there could be some interesting studies done on the brain itself related to all of this.
I mean, certainly that would be nice. Although, and this is probably a fault of mine. One of the reasons why I haven't even produced more than I have, and I think with all due modesty, I've produced tremendously, is I'm always very shy to collaborate with people because my standards of perfectionism are actually quite brutal. And I think you and I might have discussed this when you came on my show to talk about your book at the time, that it's very hard for me to collaborate with someone because I need to make sure that they write every word themselves, that they fact check everything. If my name is going to go on it, can I trust that they did the right thing? So if you can find me a biologist that has my exacting standards, then maybe I'll collaborate with them.
I'll do a little Google and let me see who I can come up with. All right, let's see. Well, this is sort of a broad one that I'm sure you get all the time and we've discussed before. What advice do you have for how individuals can stand up to these progressive ideas? What do you recommend to those who wish to fight back? I mean, you do talk about this in the book a little bit at the end, but we've talked about this many times.
So there are two ways to answer this. One is a bit longer. So let me start with this one and then maybe a quicker way. So first of all, I argue that when you're trying to stake out a position, you need to do the intellectual work to actually demonstrate the veracity of your point, right? So if I want to demonstrate that toy preferences are not socially constructed, but that they have a biological root, why is it that little boys prefer trucks and why is it that little girls prefer dolls? Then I'm going to have to think about what are all of the ways by which I can construct a nomological network of cumulative evidence to convince Dave of my position. It's a very powerful epistemological tool because it removes the affective system. It removes hysteria. I can drown you in such a tsunami of evidence that it becomes difficult for you to counter against that, which, by the way, also teaches you to have epistemic humility. If you were to ask me, what's your position on the legalization of marijuana? My first answer would be, you know, I don't know enough about it to pronounce a position, precisely because I haven't done the legwork. I haven't built that nomological network of cumulative evidence. So the first answer to your question would be, if you're truly going to take positions that are intellectual based, you have to do the homework. But now let's come to sort of the call to action stuff. So one of the things that I talk about in chapter 8, the last chapter, is activate your inner honey badger. Mm-hmm. So honey badgers are the size of a small dog, but they are extraordinarily ferocious and fierce. You could have six lions approach them to eat them, and yet they will, you know, run away because they are intimidated by the ferocity of the honey badger. Well, I argue you need to channel that. You need to be an ideological honey badger. Now, what do I mean by that? Don't be a honey badger when you're not standing on firm ground. But when I have a certain set of principles that I can articulate based on a foundation of principles, then you come after me, you better be ready because I'm coming after you tenfold stronger. Don't subcontract your voice to others. Don't expect Dave Rubin to do the work for you. Don't expect Jordan Peterson or Gad Saad. Your voice matters. If people are saying stupid things on Facebook, challenge them politely. So there's a combination of these factors that causes most people to cow into silence. And if we could find a way to trigger their courage, then the silent majority will quickly end these idea pathogens.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we got a lot of people with their head in the sand, but, you know, I guess it's our job to give them room enough to at least peek out every now and again if they're not fully ready to jump in. You know, you mentioned the thing about boys with trucks and girls with dolls. I was watching a really interesting show on Netflix. I think it's called The Toys We Grew Up With. And they talk about the history of G.I. Joe and that when G.I. Joes came out, the original G.I. Joe dolls, and this is before my time, so this is before your time too, probably. This was probably like in the early 70s. They had, you know, these dolls, these big dolls, and basically all the executives at the toy company kept saying, what are you talking about? Boys will never play with these dolls. And then what they realized is that, oh, if you give them enough stuff about war and enough adventure and you put them in a scuba gear and a bunch of other stuff, that they will actually play with them. But there was this big fight. Could it ever work? And clearly the answer was, if you do enough work around it, it's not just a doll.
And by the way, I mean, to link marketing and products and services to evolutionary theory is not just some sort of esoteric scientific project. It has real practical implications, right? Because there are companies, toy manufacturers, who were parasitized by some of these idea pathogens that actually thought that they could create a new line of progressive toys where it is the boys who are playing with the pink dolls and it is the girls that are playing with the guns, because they thought, again, from a tabula rasa perspective, you could socialize little kids to whatever you want them to be. guess what? It didn't go well for them. I'll give you one other quick example. Romance novels are almost exclusively consumed by women all around the world. And the romance novel is literally like a plagiarized template. The archetype of the male hero, he is tall, he is a neurosurgeon and a prince, he has a six-pack, he wrestles alligators on his six-pack, he is reckless and risk-taker who could only be tamed by the love of one woman. I've just told you every single romance novel that's ever been written. Women fantasize about that guy. Well, one progressive romance novel company wanted to create a new norm of masculinity where the guy cries every 4 seconds. Guess what happened to that line of romance novels? So because they don't understand human nature, it literally is go broke if you go woke or whatever it is. And so when I'm teaching to my students about evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, I tell them it's not simply the science. They are real practical applications and implications to either understanding human behavior or being a moron.
Man, you should be working at Disney, because you probably know this, but you know, Disney, they made a decision, a marketing decision, that they were going to market the new Star Wars for women or for girls, and the main character Rey was a girl, and they said the Marvel movies, Avengers, will be for boys. But then they realized little girls, generally speaking, don't want to play with lightsabers and blow up spaceships. That's not anti-girl, it just is.
Imagine how much money I could have saved them, and I could have now, I could have had a house in Newport Beach.
All right, let's move on to a friend of ours. The question's about a friend of ours, Douglas Murray, a British writer who comments on the same thinking plaguing Western society, recently went on the Trigonomics podcast with a rather pessimistic message about how dangerous the situation that we are in is. I am from the UK, but have spent the last 8 years in Japan. And I have to say, even in a short period of time, large swathes of the society I left are now unrecognizable. So just how close to the precipice are we? I love this question because the urgency is there. And I feel like a lot of people feel this.
Well, it depends which metric you use in terms of how close we are to the precipice. Is the West going to collapse tomorrow and it's going to be Mad Max? No, it's an insidious, slow burning thing, right? We will wake up in 20, 30, 50 years and we won't be able to recognize what's up, what's down, what's left, what's right. I've always said, for example, that the identity politics that is enshrined within the left is something that could replicate that which I escaped from in Lebanon 45 years ago, right? There is no good outcome with tribal politics, right? I've seen the ugliest manifestation of tribal politics. So I don't want to be too alarmist and say, you know, we've got the way AOC says we've got 12 minutes left and then it's over because of climate change. But if we continue on this path where we don't redress the ship and grab, if you'd like, all of the values that made the West great, I suspect that the West will eventually die. I can't give you a date, but let's put it this way. It's less than 100 years.
God. And that sort of goes to what we were talking about earlier about how the internet spreads this. So it's like, you know, if this was all happening 100 years ago, the bad ideas that might be percolating on a college campus somewhere in the United States wouldn't necessarily affect Canada the next moment, but right now they can affect Canada just as easily as they can affect a college in Zimbabwe.
Exactly. And this, by the way, these idea pathogens that I argue in the parasitic mind were spawned on university campuses, they don't stay on campus, right? The virus started in the country with no known origin, because we can't say it because it would be racist. It started off in that country, but then now has shut down the entire world, right? You can't contain the idea pathogens. So they start off on campus because it takes intellectuals to come up with really dumb ideas, but then they make their way everywhere. So HR departments now adhere to them. You know, nuclear facility labs, as you know, with the US governments, right? I self-flagellate and I have to take a seminar about why I'm evil because white fragility, right? So these are not just some esoteric things that only a few professors who have nothing better to do with their time are fighting against, because the ones who have been warning, myself and a few others, we see the end game. We see what it is when Julian Castro appears in the primaries and then talks about abortions and then says, oh, I'm sorry, I mean, you know, we need to protect men who have abortions and women who have abortions. That has become normalized. That kind of lunacy is not an esoteric thing in a feminist class at Wellesley. It's in the primary Democrat, you know, process.
Gad, you're not going to believe this, but we hired a new director at the Rubin Report last week, and we got about 500 resumes. And I know this is crazy, but I did not ask for anyone's gender, sexuality, color of their skin, whether they had a limp or a lazy eye or anything else. And in the old days, that would be told, that would, you'd be, you know, that's what you do. You don't care about those things. But these days, somehow that makes me a bigot, I think, according to these idea pathogens.
Well, certainly in the university, as you know, now everything is determined by those immutable traits, right? So you get a professorship, a chaired professorship or not, as a function of whether you are an indigenous person of color or not. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely insane. Well, this is sort of an offshoot of that question, but I think we can probably dig a little deeper on it. If we do not see a return to reason, where do you see our culture going? Is there a historical comparison between what we see now and a previous time in human history? Are we headed toward another form of the Dark Ages? I'll just add in one thing, which is, you know, everyone throws in the Nazi, Hitler stuff every day, and it's become so meaningless, unfortunately, and it's such a degradation of history. But the feeling, the crippling feeling of I'm not going to say what I think as I see evil rise, I suspect is something like 1930s Germany. And I don't mean that to be hyperbolic. Is that over the top?
No, because, you know, the collective apathy is what allows idea pathogen 1 in 1933 or idea pathogen 2 in 2020 to flourish, right? If you stop, it's kind of like when you talk about metastatic cancer and you give it stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. If you catch it at stage 1, it's a hell of a lot better than you catch it at stage 4. But because of our apathy, because of our cowardice, we end up waiting until it's too late. And then if we want to redress it, it is a lot more costly than had we caught it at stage 1. And so this is what I always tell people. Today, we can still win this battle through what we're doing now, through the exchange of ideas. But there will come a day when good, kind white people will not be happy about being told every single day of their lives that they are execrable cretins, right? And some not so nice white people will say, wait a minute, I've had enough. And at that point, the time window to have enlightened debates will be over, and the time for Beirut type violence will happen. And it doesn't take a prophet to see that coming, right? So instead of allowing the cancer to spread to stage 4, let's get everybody's courage to be triggered so that we can win this battle of ideas peacefully.
Do you think it's odd that something that seems so clear to you, something that seems so clear to me, and I get it, we've been in this fight from very different positions, you know, you at the academic level, me at the YouTube level, whatever it is. But like, do you think it's odd that something that we see so clearly where it could go and have been warning about it and clearly have been, you know, pretty proven right on it, that so many people can't see it, otherwise good people?
It does frustrate me because as we talked about earlier, when I look at Kamala Harris and someone else looks at, I can't understand why they're not seeing the same thing as me. So the fact that you and I can see these phenomena and understand them clearly while others can't is frustrating. But I think it speaks to the beauty of the idea pathogens, right? Think about now, let's speak about an actual virus. An actual virus is a marvelous machinery, right? Because it finds a way to enter your body's cells so that it could then use its circuitry to replicate and then proliferate within you. That's marvelous, right?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
The idea pathogens are doing the same thing, right? They're taking some of us and they are rewiring our brains so that we can very quietly be led into the abyss of infinite lunacy. So on the one hand, I'm very frustrated. On the other hand, as a scientist, I marvel at its beauty.
It's like the movie Alien, you know, that's what it is in many ways. What was that? The Abyss of Infinite Lunacy? If you're going to be a sci-fi writer, that is your first book, if you ever go that route. Speaking of writing, this one's a little offshoot. Can you tell us a little bit more about your writing process?
Right. So I love that question. I think I had asked you a similar question when you had come on my show.
Yeah.
So several things I could talk about here. Number one is, you can't be a productive writer if you're not very disciplined. So, you know, when I'm writing a book, every single day, if I have bronchitis or not, if I'm tired or not, if I have a busy day or not, I have to reach a certain number of word count that day. If I don't, I'll stay up till 4 in the morning. But that's not really process, that's just discipline. My process really is to make sure that I have a very clear roadmap before I start writing, right? So in other words, I will know, okay, here are the chapters that I have. Here are the 6 sections in each chapter. Within each section, now, of course, that changes as I go along the journey, but I start off with an a priori, really clear roadmap, which I then just have to fill in the specific sections. What that also does is it provides, I hope, if I've done a good job, the reader with a clear roadmap. They always know where I am in the unfolding story. Bad writers are those where you're on page 133 and you don't really know why you're on page 33. Where is this guy going? But if you could predict what's going to be on page 134, I'm a good writer. So my process is really to have a clear forest level view, and then I just fill in the details.
I like this question. What does common sense mean to you? If you were defining what is common sense these days, because it's pretty uncommon.
Well, common sense would be what some would call folk psychology. In other words, we come into the world with an innate sense of how things work. You don't have to really teach a child. So, for example, folk physics, that if he drops the ball, it's going to go down. It's going to go down, not up, right? So common sense is that which we're innately equipped to think the world works that way. Now, sometimes your folk psychology is wrong, right? You have an intuition about how something works, and it turns out that your sort of common folk wisdom turns out to be wrong. But common sense is, look, when I see someone who has a beard and is 6'4", and I address them as sir, it makes common sense that that is the right way by which we should structure society. It is probably not common sense to always ask people what is their gender pronoun at the start of every question. The world could not have, you know, developed the way that it did if we had spent 40% of our times polling each other about our gender identity. So common sense is that which allows you to navigate through daily realities unencumbered by bullshit.
Yeah, it's funny. We mentioned Douglas Murray before, and I think I've quoted this line to you, but you know, his great line about how the barbarians will be at the gate and we will be debating what gender pronouns to call them. That sort of seems like where we're at right now. That gets to what you're talking about, that in a functioning society, those things don't matter. Maybe you can have those extra conversations about gender pronouns and the rest of it. But when it dominates your society, then I guess the issue is that something pretty bad is coming right behind it.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, which also is common sense, is life is anti-fragile, to use a term from my good friend Nassim Taleb, right? Let me draw an analogy, right? There's something called the hygiene hypothesis in medicine, in evolutionary medicine. So if you look at kids who either suffer from respiratory ailments or don't, the kids who grew up in environments where they were exposed to a lot of allergens end up having less asthma. Why? Because their immune system was triggered to respond to these allergens. If you grow up in a very sterile environment, then you end up having those kinds of autoimmune diseases, okay? Well, now let's apply this to critical thinking. If you build sterile echo chambers, this idea, by the way, comes from a Australian neuropsychiatrist. If you build sterile echo chambers, it's akin to growing up in a sterile environment without pollutants, then you don't develop, so I argue in the book, you don't develop your critical thinking abilities. Well, it is commonsensical that the world should be one where you're going to interact with people who don't share your views on every single issue. It is insane that we would build a society that is so ideologically sterile that I am triggered by anyone who has a differing opinion to mine. That's common sense. Common sense is that life is anti-fragile.
Well, the book is The Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. I think we gave a little common sense to the people here. What do you think?
I think you did a great job. Thank you, sir, for doing it.
Thank you, my friend. The link to the book, obviously, is right down below in the YouTube comment section. And Gad, as I always say to you when we unfortunately finish these on Skype, next year in SoCal.
From your lips to the cosmos's ear.